Water State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. You have, members have the minutes from the prior meeting in their packets. If you would take a moment to review them, accept a motion. Senator Roebling, or Senator Vickerman moves approval of the minutes of Wednesday, February 28th. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. The first bill we are going to make a couple of changes here. The number we're not going. There is an amended agenda. We're not hearing Senate File 550 and 1006. The issues that those bills address are in 1539. Also, Senator Roebling, there's some issues with regard to grants that are in 801, and I hope you'll be amenable to an amendment to delete those, the grants sections there, since they're being dealt with in 1539. On behalf of the administration, when we get to that. Okay. Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 276 is a bill that some members may recall from the last biennium. It dealt with a statewide health insurance pool for school districts. This bill does come to us from the Commerce Committee, which spent, I think, about 4 hours on testimony and so forth, and I recognize that the jurisdiction
that
is much more limited here. Yeah, let me just present just a brief overview of what the bill does, Madam Chair. This, with our long agenda, I will be very brief on it. But basically, this creates a statewide pool for the school districts, of which there would be six plans. The bill actually came out from a few years ago of an actuarial study that was done looking at the cost, the feasibility of having a statewide health insurance pool. And the this bill would create a funding mechanism, and it would create a board, I believe, which would have the interests of this committee, consisting of seven members from the employer groups, seven members of the employee groups. As I say, I can go into more details on it, but I'm trying to identify which of the specific areas of jurisdiction for this committee that we can hone in on, so we can make sure that those are the areas that we do talk about. Perhaps if this is one of those issues where I've got I know the bill too well that I know I don't know quite what to limit it to.
Senator Betzel, why don't you just give us a brief thing,
sure.
And then
if you
members can identify issues
right. That
they are.
The first part of the bill, there's
about
a creation of a board. It's at the bottom of page one of the first engrossment, and as I say, this this board of directors, and it's more specifically identified at the top of page two, of seven members of the employee groups and seven members of employer groups. This is based upon some of the federal labor laws. They are to design a system which will include at least six health plans, which you can see at the top of page 3, line 3.3. They must initially offer at least six health plans, one with a low cost, one a high cost, a couple in between. The board will then, and we spent a lot of time in the Commerce Committee trying to work on the insurance issues. The way the bill is presented to you right now, the Commerce Commissioner would have to approve the ultimate plans. I think, and then as I say, this there's an appropriation ultimately in here as you can see on the back of page 6, of $5 million as a startup money. Ultimately, the as a loan that would have to be repaid back. We do have some people in here, some witnesses can briefly testify on the ultimate goals of the plan as well, too. And there is obviously some opposition to the to it, but I'll stand for any questions on any specific details if there are any members.
Senator Betzold, one of the things that brings the bill here is the board that's created rather than the underlying policy. I wonder if you've had a chance to review your bill with regard to the guidelines that were published on February 19th with regard to the creation of boards, and do you are there any issues that are not addressed in your bill that need to be taken care of?
Madam Chair, I'm aware of the guidelines that you've had. The bill that we have before us, well, for better or for worse, is identical to the one that had already passed the Senate in the previous biennium. And the guidelines that we'd have, because this, we patterned this before as well as now, again, after the federal labor law, so that there would not be any particular member or group that would have over-influence on the board. And so that's why we structured it in the way that on the top of page 2, line 2.4, consisting of, and then 7 members of representative of eligible employees appointed by exclusive representatives, and then 7 members of employers appointed by the Minnesota School Boards Association. And then they go into more detail on how they are to be appointed. I don't have your guidelines before right now, Madam Chair, but I think
Mr.
that...
Senator Betzold, I'm looking for who is to...
convene.
For example, who is to... you've named the group. You've mm-hmm. got the number of members. You have the appointing authority. Is there to be a chair of this group? And how is that person to be chosen?
Apparently we have an amendment that we have the A-10 amendment, I believe, would address at least the convening. But I have
okay,
Mr.
And that would be Mr. Bodern had alerted me that you didn't have a convening authority either. So that would be the initial meeting. That's the A-10 one, but you don't have a. You don't, or I'm just looking at this. It does not. Doesn't seem that. Even though in, and we'll take the, let's do the A-10 amendment at first.
I'll move the A-10 amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold moves the A-10 amendment dealing with a convening authority. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. I wonder if it could be construed that lines 222 and 223 would indicate. Well, this person, the convening authority, is Commissioner of Commerce. But how does this board meet following the initial meeting, and who's the chair? Sir?
Madam Chair, my name is Lee Johansson. I'm with Education Minnesota.
Mr. Johansson?
If we look at Subdivision 3, Section F, in lines 222 and 223, I believe,
right.
It empowers the board to establish its operating procedures on its own. My assumption is that in that first meeting, the organizing meeting, that it establishes the list or the schedule of meetings as it sees fit and necessary, and then modifies them as the need changes.
Hey,
the assumption is that the whole governance structure, the governance requirements, would include the election of a chair or co-chairs, if in fact that was the choice of the committee.
Okay, I think Senator Betzold, that language is very vague, and what I just keep remembering is because in the bill that I had that established the Sesquicentennial Commission on which we both serve, we spent 6 months on an item that should have been taken care of in the legislation itself. And it is so simple to just say at the first meeting the board will elect a chair, quite frankly, and then go from there rather than to get bogged down in something that they probably would do anyway but don't need 4 months of discussion about.
Insert right there.
Yep.
This isn't that.
And I wonder, we have adopted the A-10 amendment, but I wonder if in that, in addition to that, that Section 6, Senator Betzold, you'd be amenable to a statement that said the board will elect chair at its first meeting. And then we could leave in lines 222 and 223, and if in its further deliberations it wanted to change its governance, it certainly would be permitted to do that.
And Madam Chair, again, the structure of this is slightly different because it's split 7-7, so the board could very well decide to have co-chairs, one from each side. There might not be a one particular chair, and they may rotate back and forth. So I don't know that we want to lock it in and saying that there must be a chair if the board decides to go the co-chair route. But we could say that they must elect a chair or co-chairs at the first meeting.
Okay. I think that would simplify things greatly as this board got going. And then if they wanted to make changes, they could certainly do so, it seems to me, under your paragraph F. Mr. Bonner, do you have some language for us then?
Madam Chair and members, I think you'd want to proceed by doing this to the A-10 amendment and add it on page 1, line 5, after the period. The board must elect a chair or co-chairs at its first meeting. And actually, I'll revise that, must elect a chair or co-chairs from its membership at its first meeting.
Okay, Senator Betzold, would you want to move
I believe,
then?
Okay, the chair, the board must elect a chair or co-chairs from its membership at its first meeting? Is that
That's
it?
Correct.
Okay, yes. I'll also move, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Betzold moves the language read to us by Mr. Botter. And all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And I'm just looking at the other guidelines, and you do cover the issue of compensation of members. It's not a legislative commission, so it's no need for subpoena power. Obviously, you state the duties of the group in terms of accountability. Is this a group that needs to make reports? And if so, to whom would they make? Do they make reports?
If, Madam Chair, if you'll look at page 4, line 11, the board is to make a report to the legislature by January 15, 2009, on the final design. And then 4.19, there will be periodic reports after that.
Okay, and I think all of the, as far as I can see, all of the other guidelines seem to be addressed in your bill. Okay, so as far as, quite frankly, the reason why the bill came here, it seems to now be taken care of. So is there further discussion?
Madam Chair, again, I know there are people who have an interest in this bill,
right,
but whether it affects this committee's jurisdiction, I don't know. You may want to ask if anybody else wishes to testify about these issues.
Senator Betzold, the bill, if acted on favorably here, needs to go to the Health and Human Services. Health and
yes.
Human Services. Health.
Health, Family Security,
the,
and Housing Committee
and
has asked
housing
to see the bill.
And
if there is no one else
is
to
there Anyone who wishes to speak in favor of this bill, Ms. Alschwager or Mr. Johnson? Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please.
My name is Jim Smola. I'm the president of the Dakota County United Educators, which represents the teachers of Rosemont, Apple Valley, and Eagan.
Mr. Smola.
Madam Chair and committee members, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee this afternoon on the proposed statewide health insurance plan. As I mentioned, I am the president of the Dakota County United Educators, the union that represents the teachers and nurses in Independent School District 196. Over the past years, our district has taken prudent steps to maintain the health insurance benefits for all district employees. We have had an insurance committee established for 18 years. Over the years, we have gone from six plans to one plan. We have increased deductibles. We have increased co-pays for office visits and prescriptions. We have modified other benefits and other coverages. We have initiated a flex spending plan. We joined the South Central Service Co-op. We left the South Central Service Co-op both times to contain cost. All of these efforts have been to maintain coverage and keep the cost down to the employer and employees. What they really have done is shifted more of the financial obligation for insurance costs to the employee from the employer. They did not contain skyrocketing premium costs. Our premiums have increased at a rate of 6% to 25% over the past 8 years. We did have 1 year when we went out for bids where the premium actually was reduced 4%. Comparing the premiums from 13 years ago to now, 13 years ago we paid premiums of $192 for single insurance to $447 for family insurance. Presently, the premiums for single insurance are $365 and over $1,100 for family insurance. The premiums from 13 years ago that I mentioned are the lowest of any of the plans the district offered. These changes have raised questions regarding the ability to see physicians, which physicians and clinics are included in the new plan, and the availability of coverage for children away at school or when away from the metro area for all school employees who have health insurance. 3 years ago, the district changed carriers. The change would slightly reduce premiums for the first year, which was the 4% reduction that I mentioned earlier, guarantee an increase of no larger than 6% in the second year, and no larger than 16% in the third year. Again, these prudent decisions were made, and we still are leading to double-digit increases for next year. We will have a 16% insurance premium increase next year. There isn't any way we will be able to negotiate an increase in district contributions or raises to affect an increase of this size in our upcoming contract negotiations. For many employees, not just teachers, the clerks, the secretaries, bus drivers, custodians, all employees who are covered by insurance will see a reduction in their net pay. Well, again, I'd like to thank you for your time to testify before you, and I strongly urge you to support the bill that's before this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smola. We do hope that people will keep their testimony to the issues that are in the jurisdiction of this committee, and I realize Mr. Smola's testimony was much broader than that. If there is someone who wishes to speak in opposition, they may also speak in opposition to the substance of the bill, but anyone else who wishes to speak for the bill, I'm going to ask you to keep your comments to the board that's established and not to the underlying policy. So is there anyone else who wishes to speak in support of the bill?
Madam Chairman, as a member of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. That's the entity that a lot of this will be under the jurisdiction.
Okay, so you're speaking about the board. only about the, we only want testimony about the issues before this committee.
The only concern we have, Madam Chairman, and members of this committee about the board is there are 7 members obviously representing the unions and 7 members representing the school districts, and we just hope and pray that they, with their $5 million loan, that they adequately put enough smart people on this group to come up with the exact right product that will be viable for the future. We have some concerns about solvency that was resolved last week and or 2 weeks ago in Senator Scheid's committee, and we have some concerns about the reporting that this group will provide to the Commerce Department. For example, this group starts on July 1st, 2009, and we don't get a report until 2011.
The legislature, however, gets a report by January 5th of 2009. Is that correct, Mr. Senator?
Yes.
That's all. What is your response to the Department of Commerce reporting issue?
Yeah, but up here, you've got to get a report to the legislature, which is public record.
And if you could, Mr. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name, sir.
Oh, she needs your name.
Madam Chairman, I didn't hear your question.
Your name.
John Gross, G-R-O-S-S.
Gross? Okay. Where is the 2011?
It's starting
reporting?
On line 4.19.
Senator Betzel, do you have a response?
Well, Madam Chair, the 4.11 requires a report to the legislature on the final design. I suppose that, it's a public document that is obviously available to the Commerce Commissioner. I suppose if it said to show a report to the legislature and to the Commissioner of Commerce, you know, then they would get the same report that the legislature gets. I don't know. There's going to be a report in 2009, mm-hmm. so if that would satisfy them, I would just on line 4.11, the board should report to the legislature and to the Commissioner of Commerce.
Well, Senator Betzel, that does seem to be consistent with the reporting requirement then that is in 4.20 and 21, which is reports both to the Commissioner of Commerce and to the legislature. So you might as well make that first report the same way.
Yeah, I'll make that motion, and I'll, if council needs to adjust the language to make it fit, I'll so incorporate that. I'll make that motion, Madam Chair. 4.11.
Yeah, Mr. Bodern, would you read what we would need to do there?
Madam Chair and members, on page 4, line 11, after legislature, it suggests inserting end to the Commissioner of Commerce. You might also want to pick up the report on line 4.24, again, after legislature, inserting end to the Commissioner of Commerce.
Senator Betzel?
I will incorporate that, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have the two-pronged amendment here in terms of the who should receive reports simultaneously, the Commissioner of Commerce and the legislature. Does anyone have a question about that amendment? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, we're requiring biennial reports, but we seem to have skipped over 2011, unless it's there somewhere where I don't see it.
Madam Chair, Senator
Pappas.
That's
on 419.
419 and 420.
Okay, so that stays. Okay, I got it.
Commissioner of the Commerce Department.
For some reason, I thought we were deleting
that
language.
They were not getting a report of the initial report, and so they're being included there. Senator Betzold has moved the amendment as read to us by Mr. Bodern. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Looking at that report, and I'll get back to you in a moment, Mr. Gross, on lines 414, It says that the report itself must include any legislative changes necessary to ensure conformance. So they're required to make the proposed changes to the legislature within that report if there are some nonconformity issues. That's the purpose of that. Okay. Mr. Gross, did you have any other comments?
Madam Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. I'm still going back to lines 4.19 to 4.22. If you look up at lines 3.195 and 3.197, those are the requirements that the group that's going to create this pool will report to the Commissioner of Commerce to make sure that this entity is solvent. And again, this entity will start functioning on July 1st, 2007, but they do not start providing the Commerce Commissioner with reports until 2011. Let me give you an example. If the Commerce Department or the Health Department license an insurance company or an HMO, that entity has to report to us every year an annual report. They also have to provide to us a quarterly report. The function of these reports is to make sure that the entity is solvent from day one and forward. If we see a problem with the company, we're going to have some discussions with them to make sure that they don't leave anybody in Minnesota high and dry. And I'm real concerned about the fact that if you start this entity in July of 2009 and not start reporting to us till 2011, that there could be some problems in between there that we won't catch or be aware of.
Senator Betzold, do you have any...
Madam Chair, that point was raised in the Commerce Committee, and Senator Scheid offered the amendment that you can see on page 319, requiring the Department of Commerce to approve all design elements prior to any health plan or benefit being made available. I mean, that was what Senator Scheid saw as a response. That issue was raised, and that was the response.
Any discussion or questions for Mr. Gross? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak?
As to the board.
In support of the bill, but only to the issues before this committee, that is the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Nelson. I'm a representative of SEIU. We do have a seat on the board structure, so we would speak in favor of the board structure as it currently is indicated in the bill. I can assure you that whoever we elect or appoint to represent our members will have the best interest of our members in mind on this board. And so we would definitely speak in favor of this, you know, seven-person board of exclusive representatives and seven-person board of school board associations.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill on the issues of jurisdiction before this committee?
Okay. You want to move the judiciary first.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Madam Chairman, in regards to the board itself, we have some concerns about offering the initial plans. Our concern is that you just don't have a simple majority to offer these plans, but a majority of both sides offering the offerings of this plan as it goes forward. The idea simply being that you have both sides buying into the interest of this project, and not by a sheer turning of one member on either side do you move things forward, instead of sending it to a arbitrator or, in fact, to the Commissioner of Commerce for a decision, but yet trying to get both sides to buy into that process.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Are there any questions or comments for her? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak about the issues before in jurisdiction of this committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I think it's about time that we move this piece of legislation along, because I was sitting right over there probably 20 years ago when Senator Stump and myself originally put this package together as a study. Now we studied it 20 years. I'm getting tired of studying. Let's just get something done.
Thank you. Senator Betzold,
Madam Chair.
Is there any other discussion on the bill, Senator Betzel? If the committee acts favorably on it, we've been requested in terms of the committees that need to see it, that it go to Judiciary next rather than Health and Family Security Committee.
Okay, yeah. Both those committees are requested to see it. So if Judiciary, if that's the next stop, then
I think in terms of the scheduling, it works better.
Okay. I'll move then that Senate File 276, as amended, be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Is there further discussion by the committee members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much, Senator Betzel. The next bill, Senator Dibble is having a hearing on another bill right now. And Senator Wergen's not here, nor... Oh, yes, she is. Okay. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Wergen, Senate File 303 is...
That's correct, Madam Chair. Senate File 303 is the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Advisory Task Force bill.
Senator Wergen, do you have any amendments to your bill?
I do not at this time, Madam Chair. I have the bill in front of us, and the cities and the townships are working on a mutual amendment, but until we have it fully agreed upon, we're not going to bring it forward even. So at this point in time, it's just the bill as you see in front of you.
Well, we'll have you explain it, but then we're going to lay it over.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what this does, this bill actually was put into effect a year ago. It's a task force to talk about municipal boundary adjustments, that contentious issue called annexation between townships and cities. The great part is they've agreed to sit at the table. It's also a good thing that this was passed last year. Sadly, however, between the Senate and the House, the appointments did not get made to the task force, and so the task force couldn't convene because it didn't have any members that were appointed. So what this bill does is extend the task force by 1 year to report by January of 08 to the legislature, and it also realigns the current names of the committees that they're supposed to respond to. So it just extends it for 1 year, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. We will lay the bill over until we have an amendment that addresses the guidelines. But if you would like to speak briefly about the bill, you can do that as well. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and we were here just to say we do support this bill to move forward. Senator Wergen just provided me with a list of the guidelines, and I believe the only two that are not expressly addressed is a provision that says the chairperson of the committee, which is provided for in the bill, will convene the committee, and then if required, we could put a sunset after the task force has completed the study that's due next year, which is, again, expressly provided. A deadline for that report is provided on Subdivision 2 of the bill. So I think those are there is no need for subpoena powers, and the rest of the provisions, I believe, are spelled out in here because we did amend it last year to comply with all the Senate rules for last session.
Actually, weren't any last year.
Madam Chair, when it came from the House, the Senate insisted on changes. I don't know on what basis, but the Senate insisted on changes that we were told were done pursuant to rules. So we agreed to those changes.
These are guidelines of this committee.
Okay.
So that we do not send bills to the floor and get them passed and have groups that either don't get appointed because there is no requirement to appoint them by any certain date, which you might want to think about. There's no way for them to come into being because there's no convening authority. There's no chair mentioned, et cetera. There's no frequency of meetings, et cetera.
So, Madam Chair, the chair is provided for on 1.23.
No, I'm just saying in general that
that
has come out, and so we need to make sure that, that's done. So we're going to lay your bill over. If you get those things worked out before the end of this hearing, we can bring it back up again or at some other time if there is time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will take care of that.
Senator Betzel.
If an amendment is being prepared, I wonder if we, on page 2, line 7, change January 1 as the report to January 15, since...
Yes, that's another good requirement. We don't want people breaking their necks around the holidays to get a report to us, and we recommend that you either have a reporting date of December 15th or January 15th. So that is not a doesn't become a hardship. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, we will step away and come back with an amendment.
Okay,
if you'd like.
We're going to lay over Senate File 303 until we have the appropriate amendments. Let's see. Is Senator Wergen, did she leave? There's another technical amendment that needs to be made to that bill, too. Let's see. Do we have Senator Higgins here? Oh, Senator Pretner-Solon. Senate File 1033. Members, on Wednesday, we are having a joint committee hearing in Room 15 with the Health and Family Security Committee on the issues of compulsive gambling and problem gambling. The governor has issued a proclamation naming this week as as Problem Gambling Week, Compulsive Gambling Week, in Minnesota, as well as it is being consciousness raised across the country in National Awareness Week. We would have preferred to have waited until we had that hearing to take up Senator Pretner-Solon's bill, but because of deadlines, we decided to go ahead prior to that full committee or joint committee hearing, which I think you'll find the testimony very gripping, to deal with the bill before us so that it can make the deadline. So that is why we have this bill in front of us in the full committee rather than in Senator Lori's subcommittee. On Wednesday, however, the full committee will be meeting with the full committee chaired by Senator Marty. So we have Senate File 1033 before us, Senator Pretner-Solon.
And thank you, Senator Rest and committee members, for the opportunity to bring this bill before your committee today. There are other policy deadlines we have to meet, too, and so we appreciate your hearing this at this time. This is a bill that proposes increased funding to address problem and compulsive gambling issues among many Minnesotans. 3% of Minnesota adults may have a problem that puts them and their families at financial and emotional risk. Moreover, 1 in 3 Minnesotans knows a person with a gambling problem. The Minnesota State Lottery has compiled data on gambling in Minnesota. This data shows us that 83% of adults in Minnesota gambled at least once in the last year, and that the most popular form of gambling is the state lottery. It also reflects that 92% of adults in Minnesota have gambled at least once in their lifetime, that 72% have purchased a lottery ticket, and that 61% have visited an Indian casino in their lifetime. The small percentage of persons who gamble problematically suffer enormous social, economic, and psychological implications. Individuals, families, and communities all suffer from problem gambling. As gambling continues at a brisk pace in Minnesota and more individuals and families seek help, More services will be needed to address all of the issues surrounding problem gambling. We will need to increase efforts across the board to address the demands and issues that are associated with education, public awareness, problem assessment, and treatment, as well as invest in rigorous research endeavors to study the social and economic costs and to provide a comprehensive evidence-based response. I think this bill will help to address those concerns. Senate Council has indicated that sections 1, 3, 6, and 7 are within the jurisdiction of this committee. And these are the sections I will talk about today. Section 1 requires the Commissioner of Finance to dedicate 1% of the revenue received through taxes and fines on pari-mutuel wagering to a new compulsive gambling account. This account will fund services for compulsive gambling in general and will be used specifically for education assessment and treatment. Section 3.
Senator Solon, have you received fiscal note on how much that would amount to?
How much this
An
would
estimate?
Amount? No, I have not. But my understanding is that it would come, I mean, it would come from the proceeds of the gambling.
No, I know that's what the language says. I was just wondering what the Finance Department thinks is.
This is the first amount. Hearing, Madam Chair, and we have not had a fiscal note yet.
Because it would be interesting to know whether that's the whether that's a lot of money or a little money, or whether it should be a half a percent or 2% or what in order to have an appropriate amount to support these programs.
Okay. Madam Chair, indications are that it's less than $300,000 a year.
Okay. And do you know how much is currently comes from the lottery to support problem gambling?
Madam Chair, I don't think there are any funds currently for treatment. I think it's more for prevention. Is that correct? Oh, it does include treatment.
Mr. Feeney is here from the lottery, and we might call on him to speak to that.
Madam Chair, I'm also. It looks like there's $1.2 million that currently is being directed toward problem gambling and gambling prevention.
Mr. Feeney, if you would just bring up a chair. Mr. Feeney, what is being
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
now from the lottery fund for problem gambling?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director, Minnesota State Lottery. This fiscal year 06, we're in fiscal year 07 right now. Fiscal year 07, the appropriation from the lottery to the Department of Human Services for problem gambling is $1.9 million. And that covers the bulk of that does go for treatment. Other money goes to prevention and awareness services.
And what is being asked for in Section 1 would be to come from the pari-mutuel wagering. The purposes are the same, are they not? That is currently the language that applies to the proceeds from the lottery. That I just want to make sure that we're not setting up two separate funds here or to do two separate things. Senator Pretner Solon or Mr. Feeney, and I haven't gotten to your witness yet, but just looking at that first.
Madam Chair, I think the purposes are the same. Right now there is not a compulsive gambling account in the state treasury per se. It is simply an appropriation to the Department of Human Services for the compulsive gambling program. So you would be setting up a new account. Beyond that, the purposes are identical.
And the money from the lottery would be able to be used in that compulsive gambling, sent to that compulsive gambling account as well. Is that correct, Mr. Feeney?
Madam Chair, that would require
additional
the appropriate language. But yeah, are you referring to the money currently going to the lottery or the money under Section 3 of the bill?
Well, it seems to me that what we're looking for, and Senator Prettner-Sullivan, you can correct me if I'm mistaken, your intent here is we're looking for additional funds to deal with the issues of problem gambling, education, assessment, treatment, compulsive gambling, not separate programs necessarily, but just additional dollars and also setting up a special account, but not necessarily preventing dollars from the lottery going into the compulsive gambling account. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair. We're requesting an additional 1% of the revenue from the gross receipts of the state lottery tickets to be dedicated into this fund, or to, I don't know if it's dedicated, but to be put into this special fund.
Mr. McGowan, is there a way to make the language consistent so that the dollars from the lottery can serve the purposes of the compulsive gambling account as well?
Well, Madam Chair, I think Section 3 does that. 1% of the tax revenue from the gross receipts of state lottery tickets goes into this account, as well as 1% of the revenue from paramutual waging taxes. So there's two revenue sources that go into the compulsive
gambling account. And right. Where is that in the bill language itself? That's
Section 1 and
on
Section
page 3.
Right. Then the fund is created in Section 4.
Okay, so there is Mr. McGowan, there is internal consistency here with
the Madam Chair, that's correct. It's similar language, two different funding sources.
Fine. Senator Prettner-Sullivan, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I just wanted to make sure that we were getting that straight here.
Okay, Madam Chair. And then Section 6 actually sets up or it requires the Commissioner of Human Services to facilitate a statewide study on the social and economic costs of the gambling. And Section 7 appropriates money from the prize fund to pay for the study. And this at this point is an open appropriation. Is it because we don't know how much?
And this bill, Senator Solon, also has to go to the Health Committee because we have jurisdiction over gambling, but they have jurisdiction over compulsive gambling.
Correct. Madam Chair, today I have with me Steve Dettinger, who is the Executive Director of Gamblers Intervention Services at Lake Superior Family Services in Duluth. And he is also on the board of directors of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. He will briefly testify as to why this bill is needed to address the growing gambling industry in Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Senator Prettner-Sullivan, and we have certainly appreciated the cooperation and participation for our problem gambling hearing on Wednesday from the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance, and look forward to their participation on Wednesday as well. But Mr. Dettinger, if you would proceed, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Denninger. I'm Executive Director of Lake Superior Family Services in Duluth, and our primary gambling treatment program is called Gamblers Intervention Services. We were one of the initial programs that was first contracted in the state of Minnesota in 1992. We began providing outpatient gambling treatment services in 1988, and we were completely involved with the development of gambling treatment services at the Department of Human Services, beginning with the lottery bill in 1989. And that's one of the reasons that I have interest in Senate File 1033 is because this is an opportunity to begin expanding some funding to the Department of Human Services Since 1989, when the Minnesota Lottery first appeared and had its first appropriations to the Department of Human Services, there has been little change in the amount of dollars that have been going towards Department of Human Services programming since that time. While there's been some slight fluctuations over the years, we are not a whole lot different now in 2007 than we were in the mid-1990s. In fact, we may be somewhat less funds going into the department than at that time. But during that time, the demand for services has continued to grow. The complexity of the services that are needed and the comprehensive continuum of care that is attempting to be addressed is becoming more and more overwhelmed by demand for more people to provide more types of services and demand by more people needing services. As a result, as a treatment provider in northern Minnesota, we began to hear the message from the Department of Human Services is be clear that we don't necessarily have enough funds to make it to the end of the year. If you continue to see more and more people, we may run out of funds. That became a red flag to me to say we need to address issues of making sure there's adequate funding for the people who need the services. When we began in Minnesota to begin addressing problem gambling, at that point in time, the message at that time was that if a person thinks they need help for a gambling problem in Minnesota, we need to fund it. No fans or buts. If they need help, we need to provide it. That was considered to be a cost of doing business in the gambling industry. That, I think, has been lost on us over some time, that the cost of doing business is not always replicated at the need level. Since 1975, nationwide, the proportion of adults who have never gambled has dropped from 1 in 3 to 1 in 7, which indicates more and more people are gambling nationwide. Not only is that true nationwide, but it's also true in Minnesota. So as we look at about that 3% of Minnesota adults who experience gambling problems, they do those problems, but many of those are within the scope of the Department of Human Services. One of the things this bill addresses that interests me in particular is that it also addresses people who are in our correctional system. There seems to be strong correlation between gambling and crimes in many venues. This is the first bill that we've had for a long time that recognized some of that need and begins to put some money and some emphasis on some collaboration and cooperation in developing services in the corrections field as well.
Although that's interesting, but that particular point is not the jurisdiction of this committee.
Understandable. I'll move on from that because I do want to be brief. The other piece that this gets at is research, and research is something that has been sporadic for many, many years, even though it was in our original legislation. We have not had prevalence studies done in Minnesota since the mid-1990s. So when we talk about prevalence of problem gambling, it's merely a guess based on the prevalence from other states or nationwide. We don't truly know what our prevalence looks like in Minnesota. There are a lot of other pieces of research that will help guide policymaking, will guide us in evidence-based responses in the treatment industry, and will guide us in best practices. And so I wholly endorse all of this bill as a way to begin raising the pool of funds that is needed to address the current level of services and to be able to enhance them as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Dettinger. And again, we will have a full hearing on all the issues concerning compulsive gambling, problem gambling on Wednesday. Are there questions for Senator Pretner Solon or comments? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, Tom Pritchard from the Minnesota Family Council offered to testify, but in the interest of being brief, I suggested we didn't need it. But if you wish to hear from him, I believe he is here.
If he wishes to speak, he's welcome to. If not, we'll move on. Mr. Pritchard.
Madam Chair,
my name is
Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we just want to speak in support of. We feel there is a need to study to show the social economic costs of gambling. It's a growing problem. We believe in our state 1 to 3% of the population of Minnesota has problems with gambling, and I think it affects families, it affects crime, and it affects all areas of society. So we really would support efforts to study that and show the cost to the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Is there further discussion? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, I got a really quick remark. I'm for the bill. I don't have a problem voting for the bill. But we all know that in the high 80 percentile, the gambling problems are created in casinos. And so we're going to put more money back into this. And there's absolutely it's going to be funded by everybody but where the problems come from. And also, I can't see where if you come out with whatever your study says, so what? I mean, it's a we got somebody that we have absolutely no boundaries that has anything to do with us, and there isn't anything that we can do about those jurisdictions. So instead of studying something, I think maybe it'd be better just to use the money and help somebody.
Senator Day, with regard to the more expanded hearing on this issue on Wednesday, I don't know what I haven't seen the list of testifiers, but we have asked the tribes to also inform us of the programs that they have internally for that deal also with problem gambling and how much attention they pay to it, and what kinds of resources they devote to it as well. These are the sources that we have control over that Senator Pretnisolan's bill deals with. But that's a very good point. There's probably no one, or maybe there are some folks whose problem gambling comes from the lottery, but I would probably agree with you that that's a very small percentage, and we may see much more problem gambling in horse racing, the casinos, and pull tabs, quite frankly, and charitable gambling. And this bill does not address proceeds from charitable gambling going to dealing with problem gambling either, and that might be an area in which we should look as well. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll hold my remarks till Wednesday because okay. I know that I personally know that some of the tribes do put money into gambling, so I can't give you the quote figures, but I will get that on Wednesday.
We're going to be hearing from them, I believe. We do have Senator Pretnisolan's bill in front of us now, and is there any other comment about it? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 1033 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security. All those who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Pretnisolan. Did Senator Dibble come in? Okay, and then we'll take up Senator Higgins' bill after that. Senator Dibble was second.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Higgins and I are chasing each other around the building today.
Are you? And
I got to go first last time, so now it's my turn.
I would just note that the bill that was the introduced copy of the bill as found in your packets did not reflect the change in the chief author to Senator Dibble, but it is indeed Senator Dibble's bill. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What Senate File 329 seeks to do is to give those employees who were deemed non-essential to receive a credit for the time in which we had the partial government shutdown that we all, of course, remember very vividly from a short time back. And of course, you know, the premise of this bill is, you know, this issue of, you know, I'm sure we've all heard from the state employees in our districts. I certainly have heard from a lot of mine. And you know, there was an agreement to pay employees for 50% of that time that in which they lost income. I don't know why that agreement was entered into on either side, but from what I understand from at least the employee's perspective, it was a take it or leave it kind of offer, final offer, and the option, of course, was to receive nothing for that time, which they weren't allowed to work, and they lost money. Very quickly, just to go through the bill, Madam Chair. It asks that the Commissioner of Employee Relations determine the number of hours a particular employee was prevented from working due to the partial government shutdown and was not fully paid by the state. Credit those employees' vacation bank with those hours. Of course, if an employee has received any compensation, that's the 50% agreement, that would be subtracted from that total that they received the credit for, and allows employees to ask for cash rather than additional vacation time. And that, in a nutshell, Madam Chair, is the bill. Some of the arguments I think we'll hear is that it'll be really hard to figure that out. Exactly who's affected by how much, but my response is, of course, we've already done that, so it shouldn't be too hard to figure out. In terms of the money, agencies were fully funded, so the money should still be there. So either the agencies have used this money for something else, which they shouldn't necessarily have done, or the money is there to make these employees whole. This, of course, happened through no fault of their own. It was through our fault and the fault of the executive branch. And so, an agreement notwithstanding, I'm not a party to the agreement, so I think I feel well within my rights to bring this proposal forward and make those state employees whole through that period of time.
Senator Dibble, have you received a fiscal note on this bill as of yet?
I have not, Madam Chair.
It will be referred, if we act favorably on it, to the Committee on Finance.
Yeah, that sounds appropriate, Madam Chair.
Anyone who wishes to speak in favor of your bill, in support of your bill, Senator?
I don't, Madam Chair. My constituents feel somewhat constrained because there is this written agreement, and part of it is that no one can speak out or advocate on behalf of this. They're somewhat constrained from exercising their full rights to advocate for this. And like I said, they're a party to this agreement. I'm not, so I feel fully empowered to bring this forward.
Some of your constituents, meaning constituent groups, the groups that were involved in the labor groups.
Well, certainly groups, but even my individual constituents feel constrained by the agreement that was inked and signed.
Are there questions for Senator Dibble before we turn to the person who has asked to testify? Senator Bickerman?
Madam Chair, the way I look at this, if we wouldn't have shut down, the money would have still been there. So are we not asking for any other money, are we? That's the way I look at it. Maybe
Senator
I'm looking
Dibble?
It wrong.
Well, that's, Madam Chair and Senator Bickerman, that's the way I look at it. I'm sure that the Finance Department will probably look at it differently, but I think that's an argument that would hold up. I'm sure I'll get a fiscal note is my point.
Mm-hmm. We have Mr. Tony Brown, is he present, to speak on the bill from the Department of Employee Relations. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Tony Brown. I'm a labor relations representative principal with the Department of Employee Relations. I was a member of the committee back in late 2005 and 2006 that reached the agreement to give back 50% of the vacation or pay for those people that were not in pay. We had five meetings of that committee. It was negotiated between all of the unions, although MGEC had a parallel process. The remainder of the unions impacted by the shutdown were also were in one group with representatives from the state agencies and from the Department of Employee Relations. Senator Dibble is correct on the first provision. We did do extensive work on getting a list of how many hours we're not paid, how many hours of vacation were taken in place of work. So that step of the process has been completed. However, that involved going through thousands of employees, payrolls, and checking out hours worked during the shutdown, restoring the proper balances, and fielding all sorts of questions from the affected employees. It's a year later. The process, I believe, would have to start all over again. We had forms to fill out. Not only have employees left that were affected by the shutdown that weren't able to work, but I know personally of payroll and personnel people that have the institutional knowledge and how it worked that have left, retired, or gone to other agencies. It was our position from the employer not to pay employees unless they are at work or contractual paid, or on a contractual paid leave. As unfortunate and burdensome as the shutdown may have been, several thousand state employees did work during the shutdown and were paid for that time. An agreement was reached for those who did not work to receive compensation at the rate of 50% for the hours they did not work. The labor agreements were followed, and implementing the terms of the MOUs, memorandums of understanding, and the grievance settlements, any open issues or grievances were resolved, except for one outstanding grievance at MnDOT. All the employees were paid for the July 4th, 2005 holiday. All expense issues were settled. All employees were allowed to use sick leave if they were sick and chose to use that sick time during this time. Insurance benefits continued during the period of the shutdown with no negative impact on the affected employees. The agreement was reached through the labor relations process. We, the employer, disagree with expanding what was already agreed upon by the parties. As Senator Dibble pointed out, the MOU states that the parties will not go to the legislature, an arbitrator, or court to either enhance or diminish the terms of the agreement. Senator Dibble is also right that there was nothing restricting him from coming forward with that bill. But we believe a deal was a deal. The unions reportedly reluctantly accepted the terms of the settlement. The employer also had some reservations in agreeing to the settlement. We ended up with another MOU this time to resolve the employment issues surrounding the 2005 partial shutdown, and we hoped that that had ended it and that we would no longer have to come in front of the legislature on this issue, especially given we had an agreement. Thank you for your consideration.
Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Brown? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, so Senator Dibble, what's wrong with that deal?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Day. It's simply put, they're only being made whole for half the time, which we force them not to work. It's half a loaf. It's not the whole loaf, and they were not at fault for.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, have you ever made any deals in your life where you shake hands or you sign a piece of paper and you agree on something? I mean, you're opening something all up, all over again.
Madam Chair.
If Senator Day is finished, Senator Dibble.
In my judgment, as a senator who represents a number of state employees, I don't think this is fair, and I feel like those employees and their representatives were forced to an agreement prematurely. They were given a take it or leave it. The leave it was nothing, and no one shook my hand on this. So I feel like this is the right and the fair thing to do. The employees themselves are not bringing this forward, and the unions aren't bringing this forward, and the state is not bringing it forward. I'm not a party to that deal, but in my judgment, this isn't fair. So I'm pointing that out and trying to do something about it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Day.
Senator Dibble, just on a personal basis, I'll tell you, I think it's pretty irresponsible. If that means that every time we have a contract around here, if we have one of 67 senators that doesn't think it's right, and they put bills in, and we all march around, and so be it. Fine.
Madam Chair, I think we see that every day. We see senators who see something that's unfair in conversation, in conjunction with their representation of their constituents and they try to do something about it, whether it's 1 or 5 million people that they're trying to help.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would like to leave a deal and put this behind us. I know that it wasn't timing that a lot of state workers wanted to have that time off, but the fact is that they did have days off, maybe not the time they wanted, but they did get partial compensation for that, or they could use vacation. I know a lot of people in the private sector. My husband was one of them for many years who worked construction. And I think of all the unexpected time offs they had related to weather, related to economic slowdowns, all the things that people in the private sector are dealing with all the time, so that their hours of employment are not necessarily regular, by no fault of their own either. And it's something that typically state workers don't have to deal with, and yet it happens very commonly in the private sector. And I guess that, you know, this is just something I think should be called settled, and I hate to bring it back up again too.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble,
we may desire to leave it settled, but the fact is that we were the ones who were responsible for this occurrence, and this isn't settled in the minds of a lot of those folks who work very, very hard on behalf of ourselves and those we represent. So we may want to leave it, but it, you know, I think it remains unsettled, and it continues to be unsettling for a lot of state employees. So you know, we may want to forget about it, but you know, just because it's been a year since the agreement was arrived at and a couple of years since the partial government shutdown, I still think we have amends to make, and the passage of time doesn't absolve us from that.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we ratify a lot of contracts. All the contracts, I think we ratify them, and then the deal is made. Now we're getting into this one. I mean, I share a lot of the same concerns Senator Day does, and I have a question to Senator Dibble. What does this do for the precedent for the future for labor negotiations if once something is set, then I don't know if you came up with this on your own or
Madam Chair, came? Senator Gerlach, seriously let Senator asking Gerlach me that finish. Question?
Are you finished, Senator Gerlach?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm seriously asking the question. What does this do for the precedent for the future labor negotiations?
Senator Gerlach, I would ask you, when we had a duly negotiated benefit in the state employee contract and chose not to ratify that, and we took that and we had simply evaporated that contract and took those provisions out and passed what we desired as a legislature, what kind of precedent did that set?
Well, Madam Chair, I can certainly respond to that. That was part of the process where we have our obligation to ratify contracts. This is a deal that was done, and now we're going to go back and we're going to say, well, we're going to undo that. No, there's a big difference there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I can't believe that Senator Gerlach seriously sees a distinction there. If we set a precedent, we set a precedent when we eliminated domestic partnership benefits that were duly negotiated, were part of the state employee contract. We didn't even ratify that contract and that has never been done in the past. So I don't want to hear about precedents, and people getting on their high horse about precedents when that was an outrageous, shocking violation of the public employee labor relations law.
Chair, if I could speak.
Just a second.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take a breath. Senator Dibble, I do take offense to the notion that you say somebody's getting on their high horse. If you say I'm getting on a high horse, I'm not. I ask the question, what does this do for the precedent of labor negotiations in the future? That was my question. And it was answered with another question of yours, and I still haven't received an answer to my question, Madam Chair. What does this bill before us today do for the future of labor negotiations going forward?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I think it has no practical effect, as contrasted with what the legislature did a number of years ago, which set a terrible precedent.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, then one follow-up. Mr. Brown, From your perspective, same question then, what would the impact of something like this, like precedents and such, do you think, in your opinion, would set for future labor negotiations and contracts?
Mr. Brown.
In my opinion,
you need to go through the chair, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Rest, Senator Gerlach, I think it would have potentially a negative impact that we would think that we had a deal that the members have ratified, unwilling as what we heard from the unions, that they were not happy with reaching that agreement, but that was the agreement, and we would hope that we would not have to come to this committee on each and every one of those agreements that we reach, other than in front of the Joint Subcommittee on Employee Relations.
Mr. Brown, department support and testify, make public statements with regard to the contract that was negotiated that the legislature undid that Senator Dibble referenced?
Madam Chair, I was at those hearings. In fact, I testified at one of the hearings, the Minnesota Government Engineers Council, and we did, in fact, testify in favor of the contracts that were negotiated, including the domestic partner for insurance.
Thank you. Is there any other comment for Mr. Brown or Senator Dibble? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 329? Seeing none, Senator Betzold moves that Senate File 329 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator
exciting time. Wergen's
Higgins. Beg pardon?
Wergen's bill? Senator Wergen's is on the other side.
Senator Wergen, excuse me, Senator Higgins. We had a temporary laid over Senator Wergen's bill. Are you ready? No, okay,
no,
we're not ready yet. Thank you, though. I did not see her sitting behind the post there. Senator Higgins, we have before us Senate File 235.
Madam Chair, I have some handouts.
To the committee.
Madam Chair, you should have, I think, in your packets, the second engrossment of the e-waste bill. This is my annual attempt at setting in place a statewide program to recycle electronic waste. And so far we've been in, this is the third committee so far, and I believe that the sections that are before this committee are sections 7, 8, and 9. And Senate Counsel can tell me if I missed something, but I think those three might be.
And those sections deal specifically with what issues, if you would go over those issues for us.
Madam Chair, to start with, I have the A5 amendment. If we can have that handed out, and it deals with these sections. The first part of it is cleanup language from the Pollution Control Agency, and the second half is cleanup language from the Department of Admin.
Senator Higgins, we will take up that amendment, but let's deal with the issues that bring the bill to this committee. Since that is not an author's amendment,
we'll
have to deal with that separately. And Mr. Bodder informs us that it's only Section 9.
Oh, even better.
That is the purview of this committee, although obviously members are free to ask questions about any section. So
okay.
Section 9.
Section
is on
9,
page
Madam Chair. In dealing with setting up a manufacturer's responsibility model for electronic waste, we
We have Section 9 included in the bill that the Department of Administration must ensure that state acquisitions of video display devices are in compliance with this bill. And we also set out what happens when some entity that is awarded a contract for purchase or lease of video display devices is found in violation of this bill. And the amendment would make it clear that the Department of Admin can work with the entity to get them back into compliance with the law. The way it states in the original language, we immediately void the contract, and they are then ineligible to bid on any state contract for 3 years. And what we would prefer is to get them into compliance. And so the A5 amendment makes it clear that they will work to get them into compliance and take all steps necessary before they actually suspend that contract and disbar them. I hope that made some sense. And I know we have Mr. Rhodes here from admin if you need further discussion.
One of the questions that had been raised with me was whether it was really whether this was really possible to be done without rulemaking and given to the department. And I see now I'm trying to fit in your reference to rules, and I'm not sure that my question actually goes to the amendment, but I wondered how you respond to that just generally about whether the department needs rulemaking authority with regard to this and whether that you need to specifically state that.
Madam Chair, what is
this page 13, line 8? Deal with
13, line 8. Did you say?
I'm just trying to understand because it's a page and line amendment. Just how this fits in.
Okay.
And since we're looking at section 9, and that includes starting on 1229 through 1313, and there are. There are, in your amendment, starting at line 111 to 117, it deals with section 9. Am I reading that correct? I hadn't seen this amendment before, so. Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair, the amendment dealing with this section is actually starts on 1.10 and goes to the end.
1.10, okay, right, because it starts on that, okay. So what is the effect of that part of the amendment and also with regard to the question I raised?
Okay, Madam Chair. Betsy Hayes from the Department of Admin is here, and she knows it better than I. So.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betsy Hayes, and I'm a contracts manager with the Department of Administration.
Ms. Hayes.
The provision that relates to the rules that you were noting deal with the suspension and debarment authority that the Commissioner of Administration already has in rulemaking authority. So what this would indicate is that the contractor who is out of compliance with this bill would therefore be subject to already existing rules of suspension and debarment under those under Chapter 1230.
And Ms. Hayes, you don't think that this extensive a program is going to be benefited by additional rulemaking authority? Or you do not find, the department does not find that necessary?
Madam Chair, we already have fairly broad rulemaking authority as it relates to suspension and debarment. So I think that if we needed to make additional rules, we wouldn't need additional rulemaking authority to do so.
regard to the program itself. I guess I'm asking, not whether somebody, if I understand your reference, not whether somebody violates the program, but just in setting up the program itself. You think the legislation is clear enough in that regard without having to have additional rulemaking authority to implement the program? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, the Pollution Control Agency folks told me they do not think it needs further rulemaking.
Okay.
We've been working, this is the fifth year we've been working on this bill, and we think we've got most of the kinks worked out.
Apparently, we need this, though.
Well, we hadn't thought about this piece yet, Madam Chair. You know, the making the standard that the contractor would be ineligible for, you know, for that. And Ms. Hayes was smart enough to know to bring it to our attention so we could get it right.
Let's see. Senator Lori moves the A5 amendment. And would you just explain what the first part of that amendment then does, Senator Higgins, just in general for us?
The Pollution Control Agency told us that we needed this piece to specify clearly what goes on in, oh, criminy, how am I going to say this?
I'll be happy.
You want to try? Okay.
Ms. Richter, Madam Chair, try. Members of the committee, my name is Trudy Richter. I'm here on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is the metropolitan group of counties that have worked on this issue with Senator Higgins the last few years. We were advised or asked by the agency to consider these additional changes primarily for clarification purposes. We had inadvertently put in the bill that the manufacturers, their sales to households. Well, manufacturers don't actually sell to households. They sell to retailers that sell to households. So the clarification in line 1.2 and 1.3 is to clarify it's just their sales in the state, not specifically manufacturers to households. And similar changes. The key change on 1.6 through 1.9, page 8, line 33 in the bill, was we recognized that we had not included the affirmative obligation for manufacturers to have to pay in 50 cents per pound if they failed to actually recycle the amount of pounds that they have to based upon the sales of the previous year in the state. And this is just, again, a clarification to make sure there was no misunderstanding that if they failed to reach the total, they had to pay so much per pound.
Okay, any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to, does your witness care to testify?
Madam Chair, Ms. Richter is here to help answer questions, as she did very well.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition of this bill? Senator Vickerman, did you have a question of the witness?
Madam Chair, I have a question of Senator Higgins. Down the district that I represent has a state that I step across the gravel road, and I'm in Iowa, and if I step across this way, I'm in South Dakota. What does that do for a constituent? I'll run over to South Dakota, Sioux Falls, that Brandon is just very short distance. Does this bill affect that some way, or just for my information, I'd like to know.
Madam Chair, Senator Vickerman, we have been in a lot of discussions as a state with our surrounding states, and we're hoping that we can all pass very similar bills here in the next year or so, so that so that there aren't big differences from state to state in our region. You may be interested in the survey that just came showing the counties that you represent and the troubles that they've had. They all are trying to deal with e-waste in some fashion or another. Some charge the residents if they bring computers back. We're hoping that the money that we get through this bill will help the counties to be able to either lower or in some cases probably eliminate those end-of-life fees so that we can stop seeing computers and televisions in the ditches. And that's a bigger issue in your area than in mine. You know, we will be collecting funds and we'll be getting it out mainly to the rural areas to help set up some systems that that the counties are having trouble doing right now.
Ms. Cook, would you like to give your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Gerard Associates. I represent Hewlett-Packard on this. I was not intending to testify in terms of what was before the committee jurisdiction today, but the amendment and what Ms. Richter said, I hope you will allow me the latitude to ask since you're acting on it. She indicated that the program would now include all sales in the state, not just households. And I would like a clarification on that because that significantly broadens the scope of the bill if it is all sales in the state and not just households.
Okay, we'll ask Ms. Richter to come back to be responsive to your point. Ms. Richter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry if I misspoke to lead Ms. Cook to believe that. By definition, video display devices are those in the household. And we were merely clarifying that a manufacturer typically does not physically sell directly to households, but they're selling their video display devices, which are meant for households, in the state.
I do not households get rid of it. Is there further discussion of Senate File 235? Senator Lori moves that Senate File 235 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. If you're in favor of that motion, if you would please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you all very much. I really miss being on this committee.
I took your place.
Senator Roblin.
Madam Chair, which bill are we doing first?
Senate File 801, unless Senator Wergen is now ready. Mr. McGowan is here and Senator Wergen is ready, so we're going to get Senate File 303 before us again.
Yes.
Thank you.
First.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You heard the details of the bill before. What the amendment does is simply address the wishes of this committee in regards to guidelines for any task force or committees that are formed. So it answers the remaining questions. It provides that the chair must convene the first meeting of the task force no later than August 1st of 2007. It provides that the appointments to the task force will be made within 30 days following the enactment. It provides for the final report being due on January 15th rather than January 1st. It provides for the preparation of the report at the end of the task force, and it provides for the sunset of the task force as of June 30th, 2008. That should answer all of the guidelines for committees and task forces.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. There was one other issue. If you would look at Subdivision 3, you're proposing to pay for this out of committee budgets of the legislature, and first of all, that the name for this committee is incorrect. This is from last year's bill, so it would have to be different. And I also wonder, do we know the committee that has jurisdiction over issues of annexation in the House, what the name of it is? And I just might suggest that instead of naming the committees, to say something like the committees with jurisdiction over municipal boundaries, or that shall pay in equal shares, rather than naming the committees, and then we don't get into any kind of technical problem there.
Madam Chair, that would be your preference on line 2.10. The House Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs Committee is the appropriate name for that one. And I apologize that, we don't have the correct name for the Senate one. So it would be whichever you approve.
Mr. McGowan, what would be the better?
Well, Madam Chair, the simple thing would be to say the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over boundary adjustment matters. Just leave it at that.
I will ask Senator Lori to make that motion, and then we would be striking the new the language in 210, 211, and 212. And inserting the language that Mr. McGowan just read. That's Senator Lori's motion. Is that understandable to everyone? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate file 303. As amended in front of the body, and it needs to also go to finance. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone additionally in the audience that wishes to speak either in support or in opposition of this bill? Sir, if you identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just wanted to be very brief and very clear that the League has been working closely with the townships and with other local units of government organizations on this issue for a couple of years now. We very much support the continuation of this task force.
Okay. Senator Lori moves that Senate file 303 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Worgen. Senator Roebling. Senator Roebling, we are going to, this is the governor's appropriations bill, but it also has in it provisions for state grants, which are going to, I think with your understanding too, going to be taken up in another bill. And it would be appropriate to amend them out of this bill. And I wondered if you'd had a chance to identify them.
Madam Chair, it's the sections that are dealing with the state grant are Section 10 and 11.
Article 2,
correct. Article 1 is all appropriations. So is that we want to do, because I wasn't sure how much of this you wanted to look at in Article 2. There's a few other policy issues in here probably besides the grant program.
Yeah, let's turn to that.
I do have a quick amendment to make on the last page of the bill. The repealers on page 25, section 13, we realize is not really supposed to be in this bill. So as an author's amendment, since this is the first step for the bill, I guess I would like to move that we repeal section 13.
That we...
delete section 13, the repealers.
Delete the whole thing. You didn't want to repeal any of that. Is
right.
That correct?
We don't want to repeal it.
As an author's amendment, Senator Roebling moves that we delete section 13. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So in going into Article 2, certainly, just going through it, the first section does not deal with state grants. Mr. Bodden, you need to help us here on which parts of this Senator Roebling appropriately leaves in the bill. Looks like Section 1 and Section 2 and Section 3, which all deal with local impact notes.
Section 5.
And Section 4, but it's starting with Section 5 that deals with grants, and some of that language is the same that's going to be in 1539.
Chair, probably Section 5, 10, and 11.
Okay, so 5. And you said what was the next one?
10 and 11.
10. Okay. And 11. So Senator Roebling would move that Senator's sections 5, 10, and 11 be deleted. And again, this would be another author's amendment as we're trying to get the bill into the shape that she wants. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Are there other issues that are appropriate for the jurisdiction of this committee?
Madam Chair, there are a few areas that
okay,
this committee might
us.
Be interested in. Section 1 to 4 deals with local impact notes, and we actually are they were inserted with good intentions, but the agencies find them quite unworkable, and they have not really been able to implement them. And so they are recommending that they be removed. It would be when a rule is made, the committee chair, and they can still do this actually, they could request that a statement be given on how that rule will impact financially the local units of government. And it's sometimes a very daunting task to try to put together something like that, and it hasn't really been done. I don't know if committee chairs have requested it either, but I don't think
Senator Roebling, it looks like the only people who can do it are people on the tax committee.
But, Madam Chair, I think that chairs can request a lot of things from agencies, and I don't know that it even has to be in statute to put a request in and get a response from a state agency if it's something that they really want. Mr. Jim Showalter is here.
Yeah, I think
from the Department
of interesting
Finance.
To hear.
He might be able to help explain a little bit.
What exactly is being? Oh, I see. It's actually you're leaving in the statute the dealing with legislation, but only taking out the part. Being able to, for the tax committee, to be asked for a local impact note on the effect of a rule. That's what mm-hmm. that is, right?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Showalter, Assistant Commissioner and State Budget Director at the Department of Finance. You're absolutely correct. We are leaving in place the local impact note process, which provides information on new legislation. What we are asking for removal is the local note process related to rules. There is already a mechanism within the rule process that allows local units of government as well as the public to ask for information on the local impact of new rules. This is duplicative and hasn't been used in the past, and so we would recommend removing that section of language.
And so that's what is in Sections 1 and 2 then?
Correct.
Senator Roebling, correct?
Correct.
And then Section 3 is also deals with local impact notes.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And Section 4?
Section 1 to 4 actually deal with local impact. Notice there's references in all four of those sections.
Okay. And then sections 7, 8, and 9.
Madam Chair, Section 7 is related to local revenue. That's actually part of the price of government statute that is in 16A. This data is not available. It hasn't been produced by the Commissioner of Revenue in the past and would suggest elimination because it is not.
It's just doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And Section 8?
Section 8 is a totally separate issue. That is related to the Commissioner of Finance's billing authority that was authorized by the legislature a number of years ago. The statute literally says that it's related to billing associated with the Intertech. There is no longer an Intertech. It's now part of the Office
of
Enterprise Technology.
So this is just
removing
obsolete language.
Exactly.
And
we also use different platforms than just the mainframe.
And there's a lot of new language in 9.
Madam Chair, Section 9 is actually something we haven't done before. I imagine we'll also look at it closely on state government finance. But it would allow the agencies to carry over fund balances that, you know, what often happens at the end of a fiscal cycle is that agencies spend money rapidly if they have some left because they don't want to lose it, and they want to make sure that they get an equal amount in their next phase. This would actually allow them to keep that for technology infrastructure.
Okay, and but that's an issue for the State Finance Senator Betzel's committee, so thank you for that explanation, but I think that just about does it then for this bill. Mm-hmm. So is there anyone who wishes to Mr. Bodern directs our attention to Section 12. Would you like to comment on Section 12?
Madam Chair, members, Section 12 is related to disclosure to the Department of Finance. selected tax information for purposes specifically for building the revenue forecast. There are limited instances where it is useful for the state economist and his staff to understand what is going on in some of the tax items. Currently, the Department of Revenue is not able to share that information, and just specifically for the purposes of building the statewide revenue forecast, we're asking for authority to get that information.
Thank you very much, Mr. Showalter. So is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to the issues before this committee and this bill, which there are just the local impact revenue? Seeing none, Senator Laurie moves that Senate File 801, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Can we take this bill up next? Is Senator Torres-Ray here? We will move to her bill. It's not my practice to take up actually bills of members of the committee when there are other members waiting. I understand she will be right here while we are awaiting her. The schedule for the rest of the week on Wednesday, we will have, as I indicated, that joint hearing. Following that, the election subcommittee will be hearing bills that have a fiscal impact so that they can get into the finance committee by the deadline. And then on Friday, we have also a full agenda starting at 12:30. You'd think that there's a ventriloquist here, but wanted to make sure that get notices of that. But just to make sure that you're aware of that, the State Government Finance Committee is meeting in the morning. Starting again, we do not know about the arrangements for or at least I don't think we know yet even, the arrangements for Senator Sam's funeral or memorial service. If it does occur on Friday, however, you know, stay tuned for having a committee meeting on Saturday. I think that is the deadline actually Friday, or is it?
Monday is the last day.
Yeah, Monday is the last day, so we may be having a committee hearing on Saturday.
Last
if
day for what?
If we're precluded from meeting on Friday, for those of us that want to go to Senator Sam's funeral, depending on when that is, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, what deadline are you talking about? What deadline is Monday?
The deadline for bills going to finance, state government finance, and there are a number of them.
Okay. Just to get the bills into the budget division.
So you've got to get them. Got to get them there. Okay, we will be able to meet on Friday. The funeral services for Senator Sam's is going to be in Staples on Saturday at 11 a.m. So that. Takes care of the issue of both your committee and mine, Senator Betzold.
We can do our bill.
Yes. We're still waiting for Senator Torres Ray.
Torres Ray.
Here she comes. Good.
Here she comes.
Senator Torres Ray, we're ready to take up your bill now.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We now have Senate File 586 before the committee, and there is a delete all amendment. Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the presentation that the author wishes. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have Senate File 586 as amended before the committee. Senator Torres Ray, if you would please explain your bill. And once again, since it is a bill that takes that establishes a new council, we will be asking you to demonstrate how it meets the guidelines for advisory councils, task force, et cetera, that members received on February 19th from this committee. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. We have worked very hard to put this bill in the shape that will meet those requirements that you just mentioned, so I very much hope that we're able to do that. And also, the members of the community who are working with me are very open to suggestions so that we may work on amending, you know, some of the areas in the language in the future if we need to, because not only this is important to this committee, but also, of course, to the communities that are represented here today. Today I'm presenting Senate File 586, which will establish the creation of an Indigenous Language Immersion Council. I believe that I heard many people in the community, and I was honored to really be able to do this on behalf of the American Indian community. We talk about the importance of preserving language and how much easier it is to preserve a language than it is to recreate it. We know that the two of Minnesota's indigenous languages, the Ojibwe and the Dakota, are on the verge of extinction. There are only 4 Dakota speakers and less than 300 Ojibwe speakers left in our state. This is what makes this matter so urgent. Senate File 586 will create a language immersion council that will guide the language revitalization process through grant making and partnerships with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education and Higher Education. It will foster pathways beginning with the youngest children in preschool and continuing through 12th grade. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm very honored here today to be with members of the community who will talk with you to you about the importance of this bill, and Mr. John Poupart will work to present the bill and the aspects of the bill, and I'll work with him and walk through the bill for you. Mr. John Poupart, could you please introduce yourself?
I am, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Poupart.
I am John Poupart, the president of the American Indian Policy Center located here in St. Paul. I'm here to speak on behalf of this legislation. I wanted to note that this these ideas presented in the legislation stem from the interest of the Native communities, the grassroots communities, to take this issue forward and to attempt to receive state policy and financial support. For a long time, we have struggled with our children in the schools and in the public education systems. An act of March 1819, the federal government took responsibility for the education of American Indian children. Even later than that, in March 1873, the Bureau of Indian Affairs assumed from the War Department the same responsibility. And I would present that the state of Minnesota, in receiving statehood in 1858, acquired those responsibilities as well. Our children have not done very well in the public education system, and we've seen that in the high dropout rates, the low academic achievement scores, the high absenteeism rates. We want to use this piece of legislation to reduce those disparities among our children and improve attendance and graduation rates and lower the dropout rates. We want to do essentially three things. Number one is to preserve or revitalize the native languages in the state of Minnesota. We want to create a council that will be comprised of both tribal leaders as well as members from your everyday life in the Indian communities. And the third part I already spoke to earlier, it helps our Indian children survive in the education system. Our children will receive, as a result of participating and relearning and learning the language, an improved self-esteem, a pride in self, so that they can be reassured as performers in the educational system. That educators, Indian educators will also require the language skills to help teach the children. The council, as proposed in the legislation, will create a focus for a comprehensive review of who is doing what in the native language initiatives in the state of Minnesota. On the personal side, I will close with two comments here. On a personal side, I'm a product of a family whose parents were forced into a federal boarding school, and where my mother could only speak the language when she entered public education, her native language. And during the years that I grew up in this family, my mother would speak the native language to my father, but when turning to me, would speak the English language because she didn't want to see me exposed to the same cruelties that they had to face in the federal boarding schools. And they assumed that the public schools were much of the same. I speak for those Indian people who don't know how to approach this process. We come from a community that is very much encouraged to develop our languages and to rescue our language, which is diminishing over the years. In the collective memory of my people is a desire to lay claims to what is theirs, their native language. I also speak for those Indians who didn't have a chance to ask the government for help. for those elders who have passed on and with them took the language. For those who didn't have a chance, for those, I offer this testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Poupart. Is there other testimony? And Senator Torres-Ray, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but we do have a few more bills to do before our time is up here today.
Madam Chair, I have thank you, Madam Chair. I have another person who will testify, and then
I have at least one suggestion for an additional amendment. Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Yvonne Leith. I am a member of the Upper Sioux community in Granite Falls. I am also a student at the University of Minnesota Dakota Language Program. I'm also a board chair of a nonprofit organization called Dakota Wichoha, a group of language activists who have worked for the past 5 years in revitalizing the Dakota language. I come in support of this legislation. Among the Dakota communities, there are four here in Minnesota. 5 years ago, we had 21 fluent speakers. Today, 5 years later, we have 14 elders left who are fluent Dakota language speakers. So we, as a community, have joined hands with our Ojibwe relatives to promote this legislation, because I come from being raised in Minnesota as a first language Dakota language speaker. I was raised in the public school system, lost my language for the most part. Raised my own children in the public school system, which did not work well for me or my children. So I come from a long line of people who have been active in looking for ways to rescue our children, to help them to achieve the three A's, the attendance, achievement, attitude, which have been problems for our children. We have looked for ways to rescue our children and help them to achieve in those areas. The early alternative schools of the 1970s, we have been part of, an active part of that. I see here these young people with us today who are products of that alternative education, us parents and grandparents who have worked for these many years to look for ways to rescue our children and reclaim them to become the hope of our future. And so we come here in support of this Immersion Education Council to help us find and seek more strategies to help and promote and rescue our languages and to help our children achieve.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray, is that your testimony? Are there comments or
questions? Yes, Madam Chair, and I will be happy to answer to any questions, and I have other people with me who will be able to answer your questions.
Senator Fickerman?
Madam Chair, I have the distinction to be put on Latino Indian Affairs Council this year, and I would like to move this bill.
Senator Fickerman, we have at least one more amendment to do, but then I will call on you to make that motion. Senator Torres-Ray, you all did a good job on meeting the guidelines but there was one thing that was left out, and that we've been looking at all of these boards and things that are being created, and that is reporting back to the legislature on the activities and accomplishments of the council on an annual basis. And I have asked Mr. Bodern to draft a simple amendment that calls on the council to do that as just part of the accountability that we ask for all of the task forces, et cetera, that have come before us. Mr. Bodern, do you have that amendment?
Madam Chair and members, the language I would suggest would be inserting a new paragraph on page 3 after line 10, paragraph J. The council shall report to the legislature by January 15th of each year regarding the use of indigenous languages within the state and the status of programs and efforts to preserve and promote them.
Senator Lurie moves adoption of that amendment. Is there further discussion?
Madam Chair.
I think we've been trying to avoid having reports to, quote, the legislature, because that might mean 201 different reports. It might mean to the committees having jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Senator, Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair, we can rephrase it. I will point out there is a section in Chapter 3 that actually specifies when a report to the legislature is required. It specifies who the report must be filed with, and it's actually not all 201 members. But it might be more appropriate to say report to the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over Indian affairs. I'm not sure exactly how you want to phrase that.
Senator Betzel, I think given Mr. Bonner's explanation, first one, that it we can just leave it at to the legislature with regard to this. And generally that does mean a report filed. So I understand it. It's considered filed if it's sent to the legislative library. Senator Torres-Ray, do you have any objection to that amendment?
No, Madam Chair, that is okay. And I assume you will determine the procedure after the reports are submitted to the legislature. I assume they will submit it to the persons that need to read it. So, okay, that's okay.
So Senator Lurie removes his motion to insert paragraph J on page 3 of the delete all amendment. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 58064. Senator Robley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we don't often put purposes in, and I guess I see Section 1 where it says legislative findings really as describing the purpose. And even though it's nice to explain why we want the bill, I don't know that it should be in there as far as going into statute books.
You're correct. That's actually very very unusual, although it was nice to read it at the beginning of this delete all amendment. But if you do, Senator Torres-Ray, if you do read through all of the things that you are talking about that were in the legislative findings come back up again as duties, et cetera, of the council. So, Senator Roebling, do you want to move to delete Section 1?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would so move.
Senator Betzel?
And Madam Chair, I was going to make the same observation. And, in fact, this would not even be coded into the statute, so the only place it ever appears is section laws. So I don't think that it really serves any purpose.
And I would direct your attention there, Senator Torres-Ray. If you look at it, it just says Section 1 legislative findings, and there's no statutory reference there. And that indicates would not go into the statutes anyway. The meat of the bill starts with Section 2, where it is coded. Mm-hmm. So we have Senator Roebling's motion to delete Section 1. Any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Roebling amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although the legislative findings do give the rationale for the bill, and so I think it's really important that that does be preserved in our memories, and I hope that in further committees you can refer to that in your testimony, because this is very much a dire situation. I've been working with representatives from this group on the higher ed piece to make sure that we have training programs for the teachers for the native languages, and it really is a multi-pronged. We have to have the preschool programs. We have to have the K-12 programs. We have to train the teachers. We have to develop the curriculum. You know, it's a big job, and I'm very proud of the group that's worked on this, the many number of people, because they've been very ambitious. They've thought this through very thoroughly. They've gone out and gotten foundation support. They are soliciting support from the tribes. So it's very much a partnership. The state is being asked to pay a part of this. But it certainly is going to be a big effort, and it's very important that we get started immediately. This is not something we can put off, because as Ms. Leith mentioned, the native speakers are not with us much longer.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Is there further discussion? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make sure when Senator Pappas was talking about the partnership, on page 3, lines 8 through 10, it says the council may apply for, receive, and expend in its own name grants and gifts of money consistent with the duties. So we do have it clear that those partners, which I would hope would be there to help out with this, can give money specifically for this purpose, and that's how it would be spent.
It does, I think, specify that in Subdivision 4, that it says all money and appropriations have to be used to further the purpose of language revitalization.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, one more thing. I know that one of the recommendations from the legislative auditor is that the legislature not give direct grants appropriations. And down here in Section 4, there's a number of them that are called grants, and they're direct appropriations to the new council. And I don't know if we're going to have a problem with that or not.
Well, Senator Roebling, I think that might be an issue for the department, for the Committee on Finance to take up, given the legislative auditor's recommendation. And you'll see in the grants bill that there is a provision for exceptions to having a competition, but they need to be noted and justified.
Yes, Madam Chair. I can see them being, we would have to decide then if they will be the grant giving authority or the grant making authority, because it sounds like they might give this to various schools, then they would be the grantors. And I don't know if that's a good idea or if we should make them go through what we hope to have as an established grant management office instead, so that those schools applying for these funds would go through them instead of the council. And I just am not sure what the best route is.
Well, I think, again, that's an issue for Senator Betzold and for us to take up in there how to do that in terms of what best practices might be.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any further discussion? Then Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 586, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education. Senator Torres, right? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee in this capacity again, Senator Arrest. We'll take up Senate File 1539, Administration Department Grants Management Process Establishment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I see that I
did this.
I left the contents of the file there somewhere. There is a delete all amendment.
There was some discussion.
Mr. Bridgewetti, if you could maybe look at behind the on the shelf there, how I took out the. Okay. I have a delete all amendment, and then a page and line amendment. Mr. Bodern, I had given you my copy as well as the language from Senator Ma that I had highlighted in pink.
We could move on to 416.
Yes.
just the bill.
Okay.
And then this amendment. I'll be joined by whoever would like to come here from the Department of Administration, and I will just recall for members, we did have a presentation to the Legislative Audit Commission and to the Legislative Audit Commission and also to the State Government Finance Division report from that was authorized by the commission for the legislative auditor to look at the state grants program. Simultaneously with that, also the administration was looking at ways to make the grants programs more transparent, more accountable, and the result of that was three efforts, one by Senator Roebling, one by Senator Moi. Senator Gerlach was also interested in that, and they're all coming together in Senate File 1539. And I do have this author's amendment that I would offer now, which is the A1 amendment. Senator Lurie, I move adoption of the A1 amendment.
Senator Rust moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are copies of the legislative auditor's report in this area available for members if you would like to review them. But just basically, 1539 in Section 1 sets up some definitions. It also looks at the process by which applications are developed, whether it's the requests for the applications, responses to proposals, and then the evaluation data. Those particular issues are in the purview of the Judiciary Committee dealing with data privacy, and that is where this bill would go next. Secondly, in Section 2, there is a process now of what the actual grants management would be. Definition or explanation of what the agreement would be, that it's a written instrument, the governance over grants, which would be the leadership for which would be provided by the commissioner, what kinds of powers the commissioner would have in terms of reviewing grants management practices. That's in Subdivision 3. The duties of the commissioner in Subdivision 4. And there's a lot of detailed prescription here that commissioner felt was necessary in order to not only give them direction, but also to make sure that members of the public that are applying for these grants, et cetera, would know precisely what is required of them and what the duties of the commissioner would be back to them. Then in Section 3, we have the grants management process itself, ethical practices within the department or employees that are involved in the process, what constitutes looking at conflicts of interest, et cetera. Subdivision 4, reporting violations for conflicts of interest, et cetera, would be made to not only the supervisor, but then eventually to the legislative auditor, who would then be asked to report to the Legislative Audit Commission if there are multiple complaints about the same agency. Subdivision 5 looks at the creation and validity of grant agreements and sets up the standards under which a grant is valid. The rest of the subdivisions deal with the administration, the actual payments and the standard under which a payment can be made, and then that there is an audit period for a minimum of 6 years from the grant agreement end date, whereby the grantees need to keep the records for the grants. Subdivision 9 references the authority of the Attorney General, and Section 10 references the relationship with regard to sovereignty for grants that are involve Indian tribes and bands, and then there would be an appropriation. The bill needs to go to the Judiciary Committee first before it goes to the Committee on Finance. This is a bill that's been worked on by the commissioner, her staff, interested stakeholders, and I turn to her now for testimony.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and members. Let me just simply say that the bill you have before you
Please introduce yourself.
Sorry. Yep. Dana Badgero, Commissioner of Administration. The bill you have before you is the work of a multi-agency team consisting of the people who do grant management in over 20 executive branch agencies under the umbrella of the Governor's Drive to Excellence. This effort has been going on for almost 2 years now. That group came to the realization long before the legislative auditor did that we have a number of disparate, disconnected, and confusing policies and procedures with respect to grants, and we're making it extremely difficult for the grant community to understand which agency has which policies. We don't have uniform and consistent ways of dealing with grants. So this team, aided by the Council of Nonprofits, who's here today in support of the bill as well, came up with this language, which defines a grant as something different than a professional and technical contract. Agencies before thought they were trying to force fit the rules into the professional and technical contracting rules, and every agency did it differently, which I think added to the fact that we had such a multiplicity of processes. For example, if we mapped all the ways in which agencies did each step of a grant process, we found some commonality, but in the area of payments, for example, we found 24 different ways that payments are made to grantees. So I think that begs for some rationalization, for some simplification. I think we have great efficiency to be had here. Then, serendipitously, perhaps, the Office of Legislative Auditor came out with its report late last year, which found there were significant issues in grant making. And so we believe that what we're asking here is the establishment of a grants management office in the Department of Administration, small staff of people, just two people, with some modest clerical help, to put together best practices, policies, procedures, and ensure that we have a consistent grant-making process across all state agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Badgero. Any questions of the committee? Yes, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, you mentioned earlier that there was some language that would continue to allow for direct appropriations from the legislature. Of course, even when that happens, you still would want all the other accountability measures to be followed by the grantee.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, I think the point had been reluctance to name a particular grantee, and I'm not sure where the reference is to that in the bill, but I will try and find it where they are able to grant an exception to necessarily a totally competitive process.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm sorry. We don't believe it is in this particular bill. We do know that it was cited in the legislative audit request. Our belief would be that a grant is a grant as defined under this legislative initiative, regardless of who does it, so that the grant agreements would be consistent. The audit requirements would be consistent, the requirement to retain records, the lack of conflict of interest, all of the provisions intended to protect the process would be applicable whether or not it was a legislatively directed grant or one made by a state agency.
Senate Counsel Tom Bowden.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think everything Commissioner Badgerow said is accurate. I did want to point out that the Commissioner of Administration would have some authority to provide exceptions to policies created by the commissioner, and you'll see that on page 3, subdivision 4. Well, it's page 3, lines 16 to 19.
And that's what I guess that's what I was referencing there, Senator Pappas, and that if exceptions are made to these policies, they would either expire or they have to be renewed after 5 years.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I wasn't really talking about exceptions to the policies. I was talking about a legislative-directed grant. The exception would be there wouldn't be competitive bidding, I guess. That would be the case. But I still would expect that because, I mean, we have long relationships with nonprofit organizations that may be unique and provide the only service available in the state. And but I would still expect that they would, you know, the reporting requirements, all the other things that are everyone else is subject to, those groups would also be subject to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, you're correct.
And Mr. Chairman, and I think this bill we had right before is just a good example, is there's only going to be one Indigenous Language Council to give grants to. There's it's not a competitive situation, but, you know, they still would have to do the reporting and everything else.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further testimony from the public, I would like to move my bill.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak either for or against this bill? There's Marcia Abner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome
and
to the
Senator
committee.
Rest. Very briefly, my name is Marcia Abner. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We support the direction that this bill takes. We have long advocated for more accountability, transparency, predictability in the grants-making system. We have appreciated the work that this committee has done and that members of this committee have done, and we have appreciated the opportunity to work with the department in understanding what might be a good structure for beginning to build sound policy. So we urge your support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members have any questions? If not, Senator Rest moves that Senate file 1539 be referred to
as amended,
be recommended to pass and move to judiciary.
Referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now we have Senate File 416 before us.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 416 is a bill that directs the Commissioner of Administration to maintain a website with a searchable database. And I had understood that there was going to be amended.
Yes.
Mr. Bodern, did you have an amendment? I will wait to get that and offer it as an author's amendment. Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rust moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Now have the bill in shape. You can present it.
Mr. Chairman, this is not a very long bill, but it does, again, direct the Commissioner of Administration to maintain a website with a searchable database with information on state contracts, including the grant contracts. And it lists the things that need to be said, and with the amendment, if you would look at that after the searchable database sets a standard above for grants and whatever above $30,000 or contracts above $30,000, so that they're not just doing it on extremely minor contracts. And that seemed to me to be a reasonable place to begin. And also it also extends in line 22, instead of the last 10 fiscal years, just inserting that they received in each fiscal year. And then on the back, the section 3 is deleted, and instead a new section 3 is added to make the effective date January 1, 2008, referring to contracts coming into being using fiscal 2008 funds as a way of accomplishing the transition. And we have a representative here from the department who would speak to the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dorothy Lovejoy. I am a manager in the Department of Administration. When the bill first came to us, we took a look at the bill. It's a very good thing to have this information being available to the public. And then we looked at how many purchase orders we'd written over the last 10 years, and it was in excess of 3 million purchase orders and contracts and grants. And simply, the data is not available anywhere right now currently. So the bill going back 10 years would have required us to manually have that data entered, not all in admin, I would hope, but in each of the agencies that are issuing purchase orders. If anyone has any questions about that, I would be happy to answer them.
So I would point out, too, that I did get a memo from Robbie LaFleur, who is the director of the Legislative Reference Library, indicating that they now provide information on the state contracts that they get from lists provided by the Department of Administration. But this would be a searchable database, not just the reports themselves, which are available to individual legislative members as well as to public at large.
Thank you. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to ask the testifier if you think this is manageable now.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's much more workable. It will be far less expensive to implement this way. With the website effective date being in January of 2008, agencies will have time to get geared up. They'll know that they're going to have to start collecting some of the data for the things that they're entering into the accounting system, and we'll be able to work with our procurement systems to get those things that are going on the procurement side.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rust. To the testifier, just a question about the language in the on line 2 of the amendment. I understand that I can imagine that that contracts less than $30,000 the amount of those grows a great deal, but I'm just curious how big a difference that makes, because it seems that the smaller the grant, the more likely the importance of the searchable database might be to a small business. Or what kind of comments do you have for us there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, I do not know exactly how many grants are under that threshold or over that threshold. We looked at that threshold, as I believe it's a threshold that the federal government uses for a similar database that theirs in place.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Larson?
Perhaps as, time moves forward, that's something we can revisit in the future, that if we have a successful program in place and as we see success, it may be something we might be able to lower to provide even additional service to more people in Minnesota.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when I first started reading about this, I thought it was actually a website posting all of the grants that would be available, which I don't know if anything like that is available, so that people who are seeking grants from the state would have a centralized site to go to.
I thought maybe it would be helpful, but I don't know how difficult that would be to manage either.
Ms. Lovejoy, care to comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it does not currently exist. We do have, within administration, materials management for purchasing and contracting. We do have a website that lists the opportunities that are available. Some agencies, as my understanding is that some agencies do advertise grant availability through the state register.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to ask a question that is asked quite often in our committee from someone, and that is, Senator Rest, what problem does this aim to solve?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, I think that we are trying to make the knowledge about state grants for possible applicants for them to give them even more information in a consumer-friendly way.
Okay. All right.
As Ms. Lovejoy said, we don't have that yet, and this is a beginning.
Senator
Mr. Chairman, one other question. I don't know if this is a difference without a distinction or not, but it says the Commissioner of Administration must maintain a website. Does that mean a separate kind of a deal? I'm not a technical person, but does a web page count technically, and would this be part of the normal Department of Administration's website, or does that not even matter, or do we not care?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, I think we're just the phrase is to indicate something on the internet, and I think we're developing how we're going to use that language now, where we're calling it a website, a web page, a searchable base on the internet. I don't know that the legislature itself has gotten to the point where it's decided on what the terms are that would be used. So I think for the time being, at least, saying a website is fine. I don't even know whether it should be capitalized. But the council or the revisor capitalized it because I don't think web is a proper noun. But I didn't quarrel with that at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yes. Any other questions? Senate Council, do we have any consistency
protocol
yet with in regards to?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I do know the use of the term website is preferred as opposed to the internet. Website is something a little more specific. As far as whether it's capitalized and whether it would be distinguished from a web page, I can't give you an answer to that right now.
Okay.
We'll research that, Senator.
Well, I don't need to. Mr. Chairman, I'm just asking the question for the benefit of the committee. It's
always good to know. Any other questions of members? Anybody from the public care to speak either for? Did you have additional testifiers? Okay. Anybody from the public care to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Rust.
And Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate the committee's willingness to stay a few extra minutes to hear these bills, and I would then move Senate File 416 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 416 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Is there any more business before the committee? Seeing none, I'll adjourn.